That's the New York-based Mingus Big Band, keeping the works of composer, arranger, band leader, and double bassist Charles Mingus alive and in fine form. That's titled Haitian Fight Song. It's one of my favorites. Mingus died in 1979 of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. His ashes were scattered in the Ganges River. He was 56 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, February the 3rd, and we're getting deeper into the case of the IRP6, which we began discussing on Friday. For those of you just tuning in, check the PRN archives, January 31st podcast at leadstories@podbean.com. Just the same, you'll find a deeper background there, but you will be able to make sense of this program just the same because we're going to recap right now. A small black-owned Colorado City-based startup company called Investigative Resource Planning Solutions, and for the purposes of our discussion, it will be called IRP for short, went into the software business in 2003, specializing in products for the law enforcement and national security sectors. They developed a product called SILC. It's, in this case, it's spelled C-I-L-C, the acronym meaning Case Investigative Life Cycle, that allowed law enforcement and security agencies to share information between and among each other in real time. They demonstrated the product to several agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, the NYPD, the Colorado Bureau of Investigations, and the FBI, and they said the product was very well received. There were tweaks that they had to make, and they were under the gun to nail down contracts while the buzz about the product put them ahead of big money companies that were also on a similar track. But they also had in hand one official request, at least, for price quotes for the product in excess of $100 million worth of business, and that was from just one agency, the Department of Homeland Security. To speed things up, to speed up production, they turned to a number of staffing firms that recruit and place IT specialists. They thought that the lucrative contracts that were just within reach would bring them enough money to pay all of their bills. But without warning, on February the 9th, 2005, 21 armed federal agents, FBI agents to be specific, swarmed their offices under a 24-page warrant that said the business was engaging in fraud, that IRP was not a real company, and that, in fact, it had not produced any software. The warrant authorized the agents to search for and seize any evidence they believed was related to the charges. Our guests today, Samuel Thurman and Cliff Stewart, will take us inside the raid as it unfolded that day. Thank you, Samuel and Cliff, for being with us today.
Thank you, Eutrice. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. So we will go into the raid, but before that, Samuel, could you tell us what we need to know from what you will be presenting, your interpretation of the raid? Is there anything we need to know before you begin?
Well, Cliff Stewart, he's going to, I think, share most of the story because Cliff was actually there on site the day of the raid. And I guess one thing that we would want the listening audience to know, Eutrice, is the fact that the warrant for the raid cited that the federal investigators were coming in to get financial records. And it also had language in there that stated that IRP Solutions was purportedly developing software. Well, prior to the raid being executed, federal agent, special agent with the FBI, John Smith, he had actually already checked with the Department of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. He knew that IRP Solutions had several prospects in the law enforcement space. He also checked, had previously checked with retired federal agents who were actually working on site at IRP Solutions, one by the name of Gary Hilberry. Mr. Hilberry, he was a retired Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent. And he has a sworn affidavit. And everything that we're talking about, Utrecht, is online. Folks can go to freetheirp6.org, and they can see all the legal documents and so forth, to include a sworn affidavit from Mr. Hilberry stating that IRP is a legitimate company. IRP is legitimately developing a viable software that is sorely needed by the law enforcement industry, and that he and a couple of other federal agents are working at IRP on contract without pay because of the fact that they believed in what IRP was doing, and they knew that IRP was going to, you know, land some business. So, you know, obviously looking at it in the same way that the staffing companies did, from the standpoint that this is going somewhere. I want to be a part of it. And so, you know, this thing is real. I don't care what other people are saying. This thing is real. And you will pick that up from Mr. Hilberry's affidavit. Well, Agent Smith persisted and went on and executed the raid anyway. So, you know, the premise that the company was not a legitimate company and that it was not developing a viable software was negated even prior to the raid being executed.
Well, Clinton Stewart is the brother of Cliff Stewart, who is with us, and Clinton Stewart was a vice president of business. He is one of the six of the IRP six. But Cliff Stewart, could you tell us what that day was? What were you doing when this sea of uniforms just swarmed into the offices?
Yes, Utrecht, and thank you for having us on again. We really appreciate it. And, I mean, before going into that, I would like to just make one more point about the search warrant. You know, Sam laid out how we had subject matter experts in the office, and that Mr. John Smith, the special agent that conducted the raid, how he knew this information. I think it's important for your listeners to deal with that fact on how does he get a judge to sign off on a search warrant when no part of the search warrant is true. He already knew there was software. He had a signed affidavit, not just from anybody, but from a federal agent who had over 20 years of experience. So we need to, you know, ask ourselves, well, if a agent signs an affidavit and presents it to a federal judge and gets a search warrant under false pretense and knows that it's under false pretense, as the public, we have just been, you know, swindled, and he's gone far outside the realms of the law in his jurisdiction. And I think that's another part that we need to deal with, and that's why we have a just cause.
We will deal with it. We just going in kind of chronological order, believe it or not. Let's talk about the raid, and we come back to the raid and disassemble what the raid really was. So tell us what happened to you that day.
Well, yeah, I was on the way to the office and got a call from one of the people at the office that, you know, hey, the FBI is up here. So when you get here, there's over 20 FBI agents that are inside of the building that are just, you know, traversing around and going through everything. So when I did get to the office, it was something that you would see out of a movie. You know, you see, here's all these FBI agents. They're walking around. They're all armed. Their guns are on their waist. They're not really brandishing them, but you can see the guns as they're walking around. Typically, an FBI agent has his suit coat, you know, on, and his weapon isn't really visible. Well, they ensured that their weapons were visible, that they were able to be seen. You know, someone walking around with handcuffs in their hands. and they're careening different employees to different areas of the business. And I think the thing that was most shocking to me was that when it came down to it and they were, you know, they said they were going to start talking to people and interviewing people, is that they took all of the African-American employees and they corralled us into the cafeteria. And they put an armed agent on each door of the cafeteria. And even if we wanted to go to the restroom, we would have to be escorted. So anywhere in the building that we went, we had to be escorted by an armed agent. And it wasn't that we had free reign of the building, but if you want to leave this cafeteria, one of us will have to escort you. And I think that was one of the most troubling things, because it took away the feeling that you are a free citizen of the United States, and that, you know, that we as a U.S., you know, are a free nation. We're not supposedly under tyrants, but you had this feeling of all of a sudden I'm under arrest. I don't have free reign of not only my business and, but, you know, just of my personal space. But not only am I under arrest, but there are people here with firearms who are basically, you know, given the implication that if I do something outside of what they want me to, that my life is in jeopardy. So it takes away your freedom, your sense of safety, and not because we had done anything wrong, not because we had threatened them or anything of that nature, but because they came into the building and said, this is the way it's going to be done. If you're African American, you're going over into the break room and you're not going to move until we tell you to. And I think that was very, very troubling, very trying, and very uncomfortable. And again, just from the standpoint of I am a citizen in a free country, suddenly that was taken away. That whole notion was dismantled that day.
What did you see them take?
Well, from what I understood, they had come in, the search warrant was for them to get financial records between the staffing companies and IRP Solutions. Well, at that point, I was working, you know, as one of the software developers. I also worked as an IT system administrator. And so when I saw them come in and they start telling people, we need you to log on to this machine and that machine, my thing was, there's no financial records on those machines that you're looking at. There's no financial records on the janitor's computer. There's no financial records on the software development server. There's no financial records on the test server. All these things are, you know, where you would keep source code for the Silk application. All these places are where you would keep intellectual property, you know, for the software. And so we began to question, and one of the reasons that, you know, with me being a system administrator, they escorted me under, you know, pretty much armed guard to the server room and start telling me, we want you to log into each of these servers. We want you to log on to the development server. We want you to log on to the test server. We want you to log on to the configuration management server. And I'm sitting there kind of at a loss saying, well, why do you need me to log on to these servers? What is it on these servers that you're looking for if you're claiming you're looking for financial records? And so, you know, we had a couple rounds of back and forth, and then they began to threaten that they would crash the servers and you know, then the data would be unusable if they went in and did it that way and then pulled the data off, and then we wouldn't be able to use the data. And so at the direction of the executives, I did go ahead and log onto the server so that they could do what they needed to do. But always the question was, why are you guys copying everything? I mean, from every server, like I said, from the janitor all the way up to the CEO, every server in the building. And there was a filing cabinet that was marked financials that they left sitting in the middle of the floor, never went into that filing cabinet, never made any copies of anything there. And, you know, then the question becomes, if you guys are here for financial records, why didn't you take any? And then why are you taking the software? Why are you, in essence, trying to steal the software instead of getting the financial records? And so that's what we saw them take, is everything that applied to the software that they claimed did not exist, and that's the reason that they were there doing the raid, and nothing that applied to the financial records.
Does anybody have, do you have a catalog of all the things that were taken?
Yes, when there is a catalog of what pretty much the FBI returned, to the business after the raid, saying, you know, this is what was collected, and nothing on there says anything about financial records. And we actually went and talked to the FBI lead counsel in Denver, Colorado. His name is Bob Goffey. At that time, I believe that he is no longer in that position. But at that time, Bob Goffey was the lead counsel for FBI. We went and sat and talked with him, and he said that if they collected anything outside of what that search warrant defined, that the whole search warrant was invalid and their whole search and seizure was illegal. And these are the type of things, Utrecht, that when this information was brought up before Judge Christine Arguello, who presided over the case, when these things were brought up to her, that she pretty much ignored. She like, okay, well, I'll take that under consideration. But then there was no digging into, okay, let us look at the list of things that were taken. Let us look at the affidavit that was written for the search warrant and the search warrant itself, and what the permission was given to be collected. Let us look at that. It was never looked into, even after we sat with the lead counsel, and he told us in no uncertain terms, if they collected anything outside that search warrant, then the whole thing is illegal, and the raid is illegal, and you have grounds to sue the FBI.
And, Samuel Thurman, I was going to ask you, how did you hear about this raid, and how did you get knowledge of it?
Was that a question for me, Utrecht?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I was actually on business travel that week, and I got a phone call that stated that, and this was on Wednesday of that week, February 9th, 2005, and I got a phone call that said the FBI is at the business. And because of what IRP did, you know, I'm assuming that, okay, this is a good thing. You know, we're making a lot of traction with the Department of Homeland Security, and under that umbrella of the work that we were doing included, you know, agencies like the FBI and TSA and Federal Air Marshals and so forth. So I'm thinking the FBI is there to get some sort of demo, and, you know, it was something that was, you know, again, good for the business. And so, you know, but then when it was explained to me further that no, the FBI is at the building, the business has been raided, and I would, you know, I was really taken back. I was like, what? Why? And the big why is because, you know, you are conducting normal business and you're going about doing business with the government. So it, in your mind, you're trying to figure out, you know, what could be the basis for a raid. It just, none of it added up. None of it added up at all. And so, you know, obviously I was shocked to hear it. I finished out my week, and when I returned to the office the following week, I was even more so shocked because of the fact that, you know, my office had obviously been ransacked. But the weird thing that stood out to me, like Cliff said, they didn't take any financial records. With me being over sales and marketing, I had in my file cabinet in my office several quotes, several estimates for various agencies, because, you know, we talk about the major agencies, but we were actually bidding on business at a lot of different agencies, to include the New York Insurance Bureau, where they were looking for a fraud system. There was an agency in Texas, actually Department of Homeland Security within the state of Texas. And then there were also medium and small agencies that we were sending out quotes to. All of that type of documentation that would obviously substantiate the fact that IRP is a legitimate business, none of it was taken. None of it was touched. And so, again, it was like, wait a minute. Here's a raid that says you're here for financial records. Obviously, part of substantiating the fact that this is a legitimate business, what type of activities were going on, which would, you know, imply, you know, financial activity. Well, sales activity, obviously. When they didn't take that, it's, you know, it stands to reason that, okay, there's something else going on here.
What was the nature of the discussion at your first meeting after the raid?
Oh, gosh. The first meeting after the raid, conversations, obviously still everyone trying to make sense of what had just happened. And then we began to try and formulate a plan, if you will, as to how do you get this thing rectified? Who do you go to show that there's been an obvious mistake here? So we began letter-writing campaigns to Congress. We began letter-writing campaigns to the Judiciary Committees, began letter-writing campaigns to the various agencies that we were dealing with. Gary Walker, the CEO of IRP Solutions, and this it wasn't immediately after, but in 2006, Gary actually wrote a letter to former FBI Director Robert Mueller, basically stating, outlining what had occurred and asking for intervention. So, Utrecht, I would ask your listeners to, you know, kind of go to the point of saying if someone is involved in criminal activity, they're not going to expose themselves, so to speak, and say, hey, Director of the FBI and everyone else, you know, please come into our business and see that everything is legit and call off the dog, so to speak, because there's been an obvious mistake.
But what had you figured out? I mean, what were the prevailing theories in the immediate aftermath of this raid? What did you think the FBI came to your office with such a show of strength about? What was the intention, you think?
Well, like Cliff stated, after you kind of put all of the pieces together, it was about securing the software. Because of the fact that shortly after that, Robert Mueller was before Congress, and I think Cliff shared a little bit of this on the previous program, explaining why the virtual case file had failed tremendously, and that you know that they were in the process of getting another software, that they would deliver something. And IRP Solutions had been involved. As a matter of fact, when the Department of Homeland Security first contacted IRP Solutions, it was as part of the Consolidated Enforcement Environment Initiative. And that was a group of federal agencies under the Department of Homeland Security umbrella to pull together or seek out a software whereby they will be able to share information and collaborate on information so as to not or hopefully prevent another 9/11 type tragedy. And then the follow-on to that, which is something that IRP Solutions was heavily involved in as well, was bidding or providing a request for information response for the federal investigation case management system, and the acronym there is FICMAS. And that was a major initiative that was going on in Washington, D.C. So there was a lot of activity going on to tackle this problem within the federal government, law enforcement, to ensure that they had a means by which to share information and collaborate information. And the solution, Case Investigative Lifecycle Software, the SILC software developed by IRP, had 18 modules. And within those 18 modules, it would accommodate what the federal government was looking for.
So the question is there any doubt in your mind that the intent was, in fact, to steal your intellectual property?
Well, I don't think there was any doubt on our part that that's what they came to do. Like I had mentioned before, when they came in and they started to copy all of the data from every development computer and every test computer. And our question was, why do you need this information if your whole stance is that we are not developing software. But again, you know, the agent John Smith had already spoken to Department of Homeland Security, had already spoken to New York Police Department, had already spoken to and gotten an affidavit from Gary Hill Berry, which was the retired federal agent that was working as a subject matter expert in IRP. He had already gotten this information that this software is good, it exists, it's viable for federal, state, and local government to use in their law enforcement practices and case management. And when you, the more that we sat there that day, and I remember the raid took about 10 hours. And, you know, it doesn't take 10 hours to collect financial records. When the FBI went to Enron, they cordially, you know, two officers went in, showed their search warrant, said they were there to collect financial records, got copies, and then left. You know, these, when they came to IRP Solutions, these 21 armed agents were there for about 10 hours. They didn't leave till almost 10 o'clock that night. And, you know, they copied everything and took out, you know, hand truck after hand truck of boxes of data, engineering documents, software developer folders, screenshots. I mean, everything that they found that pertained to the software, they took with them. And again, left the filing cabinet that said financials, left it sitting in the floor, never even opened it. And so, you know, from our standpoint, that they were there to steal the software. And that is what we believe and what we always have believed and will continue until it is proven that they came for some other reason.
And you, Trish, I would like to also just add to that that, you know, it's been brought to our attention on more than one occasion that it's not like this type of thing has not happened before. And there's always been a reference to the case of INSLAW, and that's INSLAW. This was a company that developed software for law enforcement as well and had federal applications within its software. This turned out to be a major, major scandal several years ago. And so when people raise that issue, and they actually show parallels, and so it's one of those things that it's not an anomaly. I don't know how often this type of thing has happened, but it has happened before. And so it lends itself to the fact that the way things transpired, even down to the point of, you know, when you look at the ratio of raiders to the employees at IRP, you know, you're looking at over 20 federal agents coming into a company that only had like 15 employees. You have a situation where, like Cliff was saying, I'm not sure of the exact legal term, but basically unauthorized detention. When you have all the people who are there that day detained in the cafeteria, and then searching each individual person's and their personal belongings, taking personal belongings, like, and this is obviously in the day before smartphones, but, you know, taking Palm Pilots and going through ladies' purses and calling and pulling people back into the building after they said you could leave, going through their wallets and this type of thing. You know, going on, like Cliff was saying, as far as Enron, I don't think the federal agents stopped every single Enron employee and said, before you leave, we're going to search your person. You know, that in and of itself, the raid and the warrant was for IRP Solutions Corporation. It was not for those 15 individuals who worked at IRP. So why were they searched? Why were they corralled into the break room?
When the raid went down, was there any legal advice that you got as it was about to go down, or even in the beginning of this raid, that you might have been advised of your legal rights by your own legal counsel? Did that happen?
We did have counsel that came in that day after the raid happened. I think probably within a couple, maybe a few hours, legal counsel did show up. And basically what they were saying, and from what I recollect, I wasn't an executive, but from what he told, you know, just typical employees, like, hey, you know, these are armed agents. So be careful what you're doing. And to me, you know, and obviously shortly thereafter, this legal counsel was dismissed. But from my standpoint, I was looking for something more like, you know, we can't just say because they come in and they're armed that we should just do what they say or let them have free reign of our business. There has to be law and order. This is America. This is not supposed to be a third world country. This is not supposed to be a country where the government is a tyrant. But, you know, for someone to tell you because they are armed federal officer to basically let them have free reign, that is not what the law requires, and that is not what our legal rights or our individual rights require as an American citizen, that just because you have a badge and a gun that you have free reign to commit crime or to commit illegal search and seizure and basically putting a person under arrest for no reason. That is not our Bill of Rights does not say that is what we have to adhere to. And just to make one more point about, you know, our assertion that they came to steal the software, we were told by, you know, executives at Department of Homeland Security to be careful with these other companies that we talk to, with these other, you know, agencies or these other, you know, government contractors that were our competitors. Be careful because they will try to steal your software, and they will come in ways that would not seem typical, that you don't, you know, that would seem like in a business manner. It's not like they're going to come in and say, hey, we're going to steal your physical computer. But, you know, they use these roundabout ways. So as we compiled all that information, then we begin to understand more and more, like, you know, they warned us they would try to steal our software. And even for the FBI to come in and copy all of the software, all of the development servers, really, really threw up a red flag to us with the financial record sitting there in the middle of the floor.
In the immediate aftermath of this raid, were you able to quantify the impact it had on the business itself? Were you able to determine what, if anything, you actually lost, and what was the damage done to the business?
Well, Yutris, I'll take that one. As far as damage to the business, the obvious immediate damage was the fact that, and as you stated, as you were setting up the show today, that there were opportunities with the Department of Homeland Security, opportunities with NYPD, and other agencies. With the Department of Homeland Security, IRP Solutions had just submitted an estimate for $100 million for just one component of the software. That one component was the confidential informant component, which was high on their list, and they specifically asked for that particular component, and that is actually something that's called out in the 9/11 Commission report. And so it called out in the 9/11 Commission report as a need or as a gap within the capabilities at the time. And so that was something that was high on their list. They had seen and experienced several demos by IRP Solutions. So number one, that is $100 million that had that contract been let, and or even going back just a little bit earlier than that, the Department of Homeland Security had already talked to IRP Solutions and said, hey, we're trying to get a $12 million pilot project for you guys to get things going in that vein. And so you got the $12 million pilot project. You got the quote for $100 million, which the Department of Homeland Security is saying that they're working on their 2005 budgets and want to roll that in there. So and then to cap it off, after the raid, I'm making phone calls to, you know, just we're trying to keep things going because of the fact that if they are accusing IRP of defrauding staffing companies, and we know that no one is defrauding anyone, but in order to get revenue generated, we got to, you know, keep persisting and pushing forward. We need to close business. Well, I make a phone call to our contacts at the Department of Homeland Security, Stephen Cooper and Bill Witherspoon, program managers who were there. And
I'm told by Mr. Witherspoon that they are told not to do business with us, and that, you know, the company is under investigation and so forth and so on. And so right there immediately, there's an the business opportunities to do business are being impeded. Now, anyone who is familiar with major government contractors and major government contract activities, there's probably not one company that's on the top 100 of federal contractors who have probably not been investigated. Or I would say at least the very top have been investigated before, yet the federal government continues to do business with them. And I don't think anyone puts out any memorandum that says do not do business with this company because they're currently under investigation. No, they continue to go forward. So why attack IRP Solutions Corporation?
Well, I imagine a raid of that size must have gotten some media coverage in the local area. And once something is reported, it begins a chain reaction, and that does damage your brand, and it does take an effect on your ability to do business and the credibility of the business.
Well, Utris, to the contrary, it was as if, and I'm not going to say as if, there was a media blackout. You would have thought, and as you so accurately stated, you have a commotion going on at a office building in a major office plaza, and federal agents going in and out, and you got the jackets on that say federal agent, and not a single, I will repeat, not a single media camera, radio, print, nobody showed up. So that right there is another cog in the wheel that says this is a cover-up. This is something majorly corrupt going on because they didn't want the media to put word out.
Were you able, in fact, to determine whether they got valuable material from you, whether they got the goods that they came for?
Well, we know that they did not get what they were coming for. The source code for the software, Gary Walker had never put it on the servers that were there in the building, and so he had, his plan was to get around to it. He never got around to it, and it was a great blessing for the business because now the software is under lock and key. It has been upgraded per se to, it's about four times more robust than it was then at the time of the raid. The software can do what DHS wanted it to do then, and it can do much more. And again, it is under lock and key, so that, you know, this is Gary Walker's brainchild. This is his dream on helping his nation to ensure acts like 9/11 never happened again, and we are determined to keep his dream alive. And, you know, to Sam's point about no media coverage, Utris, you have to understand, here in Colorado Springs, Colorado, the things that get on the news sometime are a little bit, comical, because there was an otter, yes, an otter, a sea furry animal that escaped from the local zoo. That was headline news for 2 weeks, that this otter had escaped. They could not find him. Yet you have a company that was raided by over 20 FBI agents, and the agents, it's not like they came in there, grabbed what they needed, disappeared, and the news crew couldn't get down there in time. They were there for over 10 hours from morning till evening, and you had not one film crew, no radio show, no newspaper. It's as if they pulled this raid off under the cloak of darkness and secrecy, except it happened in broad daylight. And as Sam said, they were walking in and out of the building with hand trucks full of, stacked boxes of just stuff. And it does not get picked up by the news. And so, you know, people would try to say that, well, you know, you guys are conspiracy theorists. Well, there is not a theory that the local news didn't show up. They just didn't.
Mm-hmm. Was the business able to recompose itself to some degree of being operational? Did it make money? Did it, you know, was the morale broken? Did you lose staff? What were the consequences to the business itself in the aftermath of the raid?
Well, go ahead, Sam.
Okay, I was just going to say the consequences as far as morale and so forth. You know, you heard several people and who actually, you know, shared their feelings from the standpoint that you felt violated. I've said that, especially when you walk into your office and you see that something happened there that you had no control over, and you're trying to make heads or tail of what's going on. And then when you know that if you can just keep going and push the business, get the software sold, then you can actually, you know, you can take care of the debt that the company has. Now, here's the problem with that, is that while the company continued to try and seek clients, every time the company went somewhere, they would be contacted by Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch. At least in one case, there was the city of Philadelphia was ready to sign on the line, and this was prior to indictment. So, right at this point, the only thing that has happened is the fact that the company had been raided, and the fact that obviously, you know, they're telling other agencies that we're working with not to do business with us, but there was no indictment. I don't even think there had been one grand jury. That grand jury came back with a no bill. That grand jury said, this is a debt collection case. This is nothing criminal here that this company has done. Well, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch didn't like that answer, obviously. So he convenes a second and impanels a second grand jury. And in that second grand jury, instead of calling several witnesses who could really shed light on how what IRP Solutions was all about, he only called one witness, and that witness was FBI agent Robert Mullen. And after that grand jury, then, you know, the IRP 6 were indicted. But back to the Philadelphia story, David and Gary went to Philadelphia because Philadelphia was having problems with one of the software solutions that they were trying to deploy. Motorola and IBM were working on that, and they had not delivered. After Gary and David did demos for the city of Philadelphia, they saw this thing, and they were like, man, Silk can do what we needed to do. And ready to sign on the line, the inspector general in Philadelphia was contacted and said, these guys are about to be indicted. So let me restate that. They are about to be indicted. Again, there was not even an indictment. There was not a grand jury that had heard it, and Philadelphia backed out because of that. And Philadelphia made the comment that, okay, we deal with companies, and like I was stating earlier, the city of Philadelphia said that we deal with companies that are under investigation all the time. But, you know, the federal government is saying, you guys are getting ready to be indicted. So we're going to have to pull the plug. We're sorry, but we're going to have to pull the plug. So, Utrecht, not only did IRP suffer a hit even there, but the city of Philadelphia. They had a need that could not be fulfilled because you have someone saying that this company is a front, or this company is no good, or this company is involved in this or that. So they are impacting the safety of people in this country all across the board because someone is trying to shut IRP down.
Did some company take your place? Is your product by such facts been rendered, has it been rendered basically redundant? Did somebody come up with a Silk program?
Absolutely not. I mean, when you look at the program that Sam spoke about earlier, the virtual case file, which in 2005, the former director, Robert Mueller, had to stand before Congress and say, how it is that the FBI, as an agency, has squandered $425 million of taxpayer money on this case management software that did not work. I mean, they had to scrap the whole system. And this was a couple months after the raid on IRP. And in there, Director Mueller had said, you know, we don't have anything. Basically, I don't have any answers for you. We lost $500 million, but I'll have something in the next year. Well, how is it you were trying to have this software developed for 3 years? You come back with absolutely nothing, at the tune of $500 million wasted, but yet you can make the claim that you're going to have something within a year. Maybe he thought he had in hand the Silk software and he would be able to make changes and implement it. Who knows what his thought process was. But after the virtual case file, then more funding was given to the tune of $800 million to Lockheed Martin to create what is known as the Sentinel Project. This Sentinel Project was supposed to be the replacement for virtual case file. Well, the Sentinel Project has since failed as well. In 2012, the Inspector General did a report, and in this report on the Sentinel Project, it said that if this software were implemented, that it would open up the federal government, our information handling, basically to security breaches. So in layman's terms, that means it doesn't work either. And if they use it, it'll cause more problems than if they continue on their old system. So right now, you look at the fact that between these two initiatives, there has been over $1 billion wasted that they have nothing to show for, and the Silk, and these are all competitors to the Silk software. The Silk software is, like I said, under lock and key, but the men with the answers have been locked up in federal prison for 18 months down in Florence, Colorado. And they're the ones who have the solution, and the country is still at the point of vulnerability with no solution that gives them the capability to share data between agencies. So we're still vulnerable, and there's nothing that they have in hand.
But IRP itself as a brand has taken quite a beating. You had this raid. So that it is on paper, it has happened, the company can be stigmatized as a company that has been raided. It doesn't matter in some cases, you know, that whether anything has come of it or not. Just the fact that you associate a company with an FBI raid is already enough damage. You had your offices turned upside down. You had very important things confiscated and copied, and who knows what happened to that. Does IRP actually exist now with the core leadership now in prison, doing up to as many as 10 years in prison, and we will get to that. But what has happened to the company itself? Is it viable anymore?
Well, the company in name is not in business. You know, with all that has happened, that, you know, you mentioned in the executives being out of the picture for the time being. But the product and, you know, the treasure that is the Silk software is the important part. And like I said, that still does exist. It is more robust than it ever was then. And we understand and realize that that is what the government needs. You know, they've tried with several different companies to try to get it done. They tried with Lockheed, they tried with SAIC, they tried with IBM, they tried with Motorola, and these companies do not have the answer. And so, you know, the name of the company is not important. It's the product that they're trying to deliver, which they have not been able to. And as I mentioned before, you know, the Silk software is Gary Walker's brainchild, and we will ensure that his dream goes on.
Well, we're coming to the close. I'd like you to talk a bit about these men and your efforts, Sam Thurman and Cliff Stewart, under the rubric of a just cause. What is it that you're hoping to do?
Well, Utris, obviously, you know, we are seeking, as a just cause, seeking to have the men exonerated, have their names cleared of any wrongdoing, and have them back home with their families. You know, this thing, and you know, as far as the media is concerned, that's why we have such an appreciation for you and your program and other hosts like you who obviously, you know, see that there is something sinister here and something obviously went wrong. And we want to expose the truth and get it out there. We're seeking that if anyone has any inroads within the federal government into the Department of Justice, Attorney General Eric Holder. We are calling his office on a daily basis to bring awareness to this. We're putting out press releases. And when you talk about the gentleman himself, you know, Gary Walker, all these guys, patriotic gentlemen, family men, Christian men, ethical men, and I think that is very important to say. Gary Walker, he was had a presidential appointment to the Air Force Academy. He didn't finish at the Air Force Academy because he wanted to fly, but yet and still he pursued and got his BS degree in software and computer technology from the University of Colorado. David Banks, he was a former Air Force, Navy air traffic controller. Clinton Stewart, who is Cliff's brother, he was an NCO in the Air Force handling top secret information. Both Kendrick Barnes and Demetrius Harper, they are the product of men. Their fathers were 20-plus year veterans in the Army. David Banks' father was also 20-plus year veteran in the Army. And then Dave Zerpolo, he had a technology degree, and I believe it's from Northwestern. And many years, all these guys had many years of technology experience. So we're not talking about – they don't fit the mold of what the federal prosecutor tried to paint them as being. These guys are very solid and strong in their technology background, and so we're striving to get them home.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with me today and for giving us again another primer, a backgrounder on what this case turned out to be, the background of it, so we can appreciate all the things that are to come. I would venture to say the next chapter will be the charges and the trial, and we will be able to link these dots to see what has happened here and what continues to happen here. But I hope that by taking it one piece at a time and being pretty thorough in discussing it, we can make greater sense for people to connect these dots. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Really, I greatly appreciate it. And I wish
thank you, Utris. Yes. And if folks can check freetheirp6.org, they will be able to get a lot of additional information available as well.
Thank you. Thanks again. And we'll meet again when we start talking about the legal stuff. That's when it gets even more complicated. Thanks a lot, though, for simplifying things so that we could follow along with you today. Thank you. Well, I'm hoping that you're connecting the dots. This is what happens in a country where people, you know, you talk about all these rights and people have all these rights. What they just told you was, you know, one day, February the 9th, 2005, nobody had rights. 20 people show up and you have no rights. And all of this is going on in a kind of a hermetically sealed vacuum of sorts. Nothing is getting out about this case, but there's a fight. And it's a good fight. Again, go check it out yourself. It's the irp6.org, and you would get more information, some background information that will take you deeper into this case. Tomorrow, of course, it's open forum, and you know what that means. The airwaves belong to you, so you get to express yourselves and say what's on your mind. You haven't had a chance since last week to say what's on your mind. I'm almost afraid to tune in tomorrow. But stay tuned right here. Richard Martin comes up next with Wake Up Call. Thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Bye-bye.